Dr. Riley apologizes he can't make the call this morning. And I know I heard from Drs. Jones and Chambers that they can't make the call, but those are the only three I heard from.
Okay.
They're going to make a dazzling presentation on public access policy.
Well, up to them to figure it out. I know, it really is kind of weird. It's so important, but until people have started dabbling in it, I don't think it makes much sense. You know what I mean? But I don't know if you saw, but I'm requiring everyone to have the PHS 2590 type thing for their mid-year progress report so that everyone can start seeing all of what it looks like.
Hello, it's Michelle here.
I was going to give a pop quiz.
Good. I'm just going to say that Sarah and I might have the opportunity to ace it. I'm just putting it out there.
Yeah. Did I hear Michelle come on?
Yes,
I'm here.
Oh, sorry to have barged in right when you came on.
I'm having trouble with WebEx, so I'm going to restart my computer, so that's fine.
Yeah, I'm having troubles as well.
Oh, boy.
What is the trouble?
Just not coming in. I don't know. I'm not sure it's WebEx. It might be my computer, so I'm restarting.
Well, it says you're on, Sarah.
Oh.
I think she's just trying to get out of the presentation.
I think I was already called out as acing the exam, so I think I'm good.
On, Sarah.
And while people are logging on, we have a new face in the room here with us. Mohammed, why don't you just tell people briefly who you are?
Hi, it's Mohammed Akbar. I'm detailing in our department, division. And basically, I used to work in intramural. Now I'm detailing in extramural. So I'm joining this conference call and with Dale and Bill. So.
Welcome. he was in the other building here at NAAA, and he looked across the way and saw the glamour.
he was intrigued.
Yes.
Okay. I think my WebEx is getting up. So we've had a lot of people joining in. I'll just go through a roll to see who's on. Is Michael Tarnas on? Bill Barnett?
Yes.
Okay. Kathy Sulik?
I'm here.
Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Elizabeth Sowell?
Yes.
Okay. Is Chris on? And Jeff Wozniak?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Sarah's on. Tatiana?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay. Is Peter on?
Yep, I'm here.
Oh, hi. Deepak? No, Deepak Johan?
I'm here.
Hello. Tom and Kathy?
We're here.
Okay, you are here. I thought for some reason you were going to be off. Faye? Don?
Yes.
Hannah? Dan? Is Dan Savage on? Susan Tapert? And I know Dale, you're on, and Bill, you're on.
Yep.
And Mohammed is our guest. Okay, so as Jill mentioned, Ed's not on, so I'm looking over the agenda. And I guess we'll start then with Dale, you and Bill. Did you have slides that you wanted to be presenting through the WebEx, or are you just going to be talking us through your South African experience?
We didn't put any slides together, but we could speak for a few minutes and entertain any questions that anyone had. I guess just to start, Dale and I went for a site visit to South Africa for about 8 days, and this overlapped the shutdown of the federal government. So we were over there for the shutdown. We visited four sites, Andy and Joe Jacobson's research group. We spent the day with them. stop me if you've got any questions, but I figured we'd just sort of briefly highlight some of the things. We saw their imaging center, Cubic, which is at, I believe it's the medical campus at Stellenbosch University. They took a community clinic where they were recruiting and doing longitudinal assessments and also recruiting a new cohort, and that was in the Hanover Park area, and that's where we got to see Leah in action. I don't know if she's on the call.
No, I am, but I've heard about it.
with the 3D camera, and so that was really neat to see in action. And she did a great job with the kids. Dale and I were very impressed on how she was a calming influence to the kids, and so it was great to see. We also got to see Jean Hoime, others doing some dysmorphology assessments, and I think their clinic went for about 2 weeks, and I think it was 2 weeks, maybe 10 days.
It was 2 weeks. Yep.
Got in.
It was 2 weeks. Yeah. Sorry.
Yep. So that, I think they saw about 300 kids.
Oh.
And then we visited their labs at UCT and discussed a couple of the R21s they have to look at infant numerosity and their choline study. We also visited Phil May's group for a day or so. We got to sort of hear about what they're doing with Phil's R01 there, or I guess it's a U01. And his group also took us to the Wellington area where they've done a lot of recruiting in the past in the elementary schools there. Dale, do you have anything to add? We spent some time, most of our time was spent with Hein Odendahl's group. Hein's the PI on the PAST network, as many of you know, and his main setup is at Tigerberg Hospital, where he's got a small army of clinical coordinators doing physiological assessments on newborns and maternal interviews and you know their studies centered around stillbirth and SIDS and the role alcohol plays in that. So we spent about 2.5 days with Hein's group, and finally we did see Colleen Adams for the day we were leaving South Africa. We talked. Colleen showed us around UCT and told us a little bit about, showed us a little bit of the infrastructure that she has there. And Colleen, if Ed was on, he may be able to speak to where she's at in terms of a developmental project, getting a small cohort of kids reestablished, I guess you could say, her plans to do some physical screening and dysmorphology assessments and maternal questionnaires. So I don't believe she started those studies per se. I think that IRB is approval still pending, but so we did. So that was nice. We did spend a morning with Colleen. So all in all, scientifically, it was very nice to see all the research projects in full swing. And Dale and I did get to spend a little bit of time sightseeing over a weekend. For anyone who hasn't been to South Africa, it's a very beautiful place. That's about all I had.
And there was a little drama with the closure of the federal government. It made it interesting. Our trip was we wanted to coincide with the 2 weeks that the Jacobson's clinic would be underway so that we could see that. And during the first of those 2 weeks, we had a face-to-face meeting with the PAST network here in D.C. kind of had it shifted to the second week, which is the one that ran over into the current fiscal year. And as we got up closer to that day, we were literally going to leave from the PATH network face-to-face and go to the airport and go to South Africa. But once it started dawning on us that the possibility of a shutdown was really looming large, we quickly shifted our trip a couple days earlier, so that if the government were to shut down, and it did, we might be recalled and asked to get on the next plane back. So we wanted to have as much time on the ground there, rather than fly there for 2 days, be there for 2 days, and fly back for 2 days. And I'm exaggerating a little bit there, but this way it worked out well. As it turned out, we didn't get recalled. We were able to take the flight we'd originally planned, but we spent half our time trying to explain to people why does it matter to the government that we stop talking to them and get on the first plane back, which didn't happen, but we didn't have a good answer. We're willing to go out of pocket a few nights. But it was really quite an experience. We got to meet a lot of people who we've heard a lot about over the years face-to-face and see physically the places that they do their work in, and we were just really impressed by everything we saw.
So what is up with Colleen's developmental project? I mean, does she have one? Is she planning on imaging, or?
So she has one, and we're funding it through some of the carryover money that that Ed has with the administrative corps. It hasn't been funded very long, and it was basically to establish a small cohort. Kids, I think 40 kids.
Three kids?
40.
Oh.
20 heavily exposed and 20 controls.
Okay.
And it was basically to get that reestablished.
Yeah.
I don't think there was any imaging involved.
Okay.
It was mainly physical screening. I think there was some neuro assessment, maternal questionnaires kind of things. And if I recall correctly, she hasn't begun that. I think there's still some IRB things that are being worked out, but it was a very large-scale project.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Bill and Dale about the trip? I'm glad you guys were able to stay. I thought you guys did come back earlier than planned.
No, it turned out we were able to stay the full duration of our planned trip. Yeah.
Hi, this is Hannah. I'm sorry I just got on late on the call. I guess I missed your report, Dale.
Yeah, hi, Hannah. Bill Dunn and I were telling people about our trip to South Africa and just the wonderful things we saw at the various sites we visited, including Heinz site there at Tigerberg in Stellenbosch.
Had you been there before?
No, first time for both of us, and it was...
Oh, wow.
It was tremendous.
Yeah, impressive.
Yeah.
Good.
There were some other people, I think, that joined us late. I heard a lot of beeps.
It's Michael Charnas. How is everybody?
Oh, hi, Michael.
Hi, it's Susan Papert.
Hi, Susan.
And Dan.
Hi, Dan.
Hi, this is Deepak Sarkar.
Hi, Deepak. Okay, so for those of you who came on late, Ed's not on the call, and we just heard about South Africa. So, Bill and Dale, do you want to tell us a little more about NIH public access policy?
We can think of nothing more interesting. I am now the presenter. So maybe you're seeing my desktop here.
Just under the quick start, you just have to select that share my desktop.
Okay, let me try to find that again. I'm a little disoriented. Okay, I see it now. And I've clicked it.
There you go.
Okay, great. Interesting. My whole screen turned blue. Now it's back.
There
now
we go.
It's...
There he is. Okay.
Okay, so can people see the slide there?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to just start a little discussion. Actually, as a follow-on to what Jill has already initiated, and that came up on the last call, Ed was saying they hit, I guess they were pulling their hair out over a T32 because of some things related to the public access policy, and there have been changes recently that account for that. So we thought we'd talk about it and just get people a little more familiar with it and where things are going with this public access policy. This is the main portal, NIH portal, for all things public access related to publications. And we've actually had this policy in place for now going on over 7 or 8 years, I think. So it shouldn't be a complete secret to most of you. But the idea is that research that and publications that emanate from NIH funding are to find their way into the public domain within 12 months. And so that way, it's available for the whole scientific community to access it and see what these taxpayer dollars are doing, I suppose. The way we always start this story is, okay, what papers are applicable? So I'm just looking at and showing you that there are some very straightforward places you can find this information on this web page, which many of you will probably be familiar with already. But basically, the papers, publications that we're talking about have to have been peer-reviewed, and they have to have been accepted for publication after this April date in 2008. So this is all becoming kind of ancient history, so that second bullet is really rarely the issue these days. And then the third of the points has to do with it arising from direct funding from an NIH grant or cooperative agreement, which is what's relevant to this group. There are, you can see some additional contract and intramural and NIH employee sorts of criteria that can apply, but that's not what's operative here in this consortium. It's the fact that you're getting direct funding for your cooperative agreement grants. So this is a good starting point to try to decide if it's relevant. I think one murky area that people often get confused about is whether review articles apply, whether this applies to review articles, and it certainly can. You might cite your grant in that review article. It might be dovetailed with your aims, and it's could be thought of as a product of your grant. Now we on this side can never see what dollars you're spending and for what. This is for you to determine. But don't just automatically assume review articles are not relevant to this policy. Is that clear?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Moving on. So you have to show evidence of compliance. And until very recently, the way you had to do that is, you know, in your progress reports or any report or application you submit to the NIH, when you cite a publication of yours that fits this, you know, the inclusion criteria here, that you would have to demonstrate at the end of that citation what the current evidence of compliance is. And I say current because, as you probably know, the what will suffice as evidence shifts over time, and we'll look at that in more detail. And this slide kind of shows that. There's different forms of compliance in the early stages of a publication's life, but it all begins when the manuscript is accepted by the publisher. Then you go through for most journals, you go through this period where it's in press, and then there's this physical collection of papers published as the journal that comes out on a certain date, and your paper happens to be in there, and that is what I'm calling the publication date. It's a little confusing to me. I don't have it sorted out in my own mind with purely online journals, what the trigger dates are. But with your standard journals that actually publish a paper issue, that's an important date because while you have to show compliance from if you take it literally from the moment a manuscript has been submitted for has been accepted for publication, you have to show compliance from that point on, and there's this period of time up until 3 months after the publication on the far right over here, where there's various kind of interim forms of showing this compliance, such as showing an NIHMS number. So as we'll see in the next slide, there are different paths that papers take to become compliant, and compliance ultimately means being in PubMed Central, which is the free and open access site where the papers have to be ultimately deposited. And those papers that make their way into PubMed Central get issued a PMC ID number, and this is colored gold for a reason, because when you have that PMC ID number, that publication is set for life, okay? Whereas the National Institutes of Health Manuscript Submission System number, which is a stepping stone towards getting into PubMed Central for certain types of journals, this can suffice during this interim period prior to 3 months after publication. And as we'll see in the next slide, there are a couple categories of papers that are submitted by journals that have worked out special arrangements with the NIH, which we call PubMed Central journals. And so in those cases, during this interim period, this PMC journal in process is sufficient. So when you display these citations in a report or an application, you should always maybe put in brackets at the end of the citation what that evidence is. It could be the NIHMS number, the PMC ID number, or this phrase, PMC journal in process. When you have a PMC ID number, just use that. That's good for life, and that's crystal clear. We as program officers, when we see these other interim ones, we still have to drill down and see if they're still applicable or has the paper moved beyond 3 months past its publication date. So just go with the PMC ID number if you've received it. So this is taken from the website, and basically it shows four different categories of papers that take slightly different paths towards the ultimate goal, as you can see on the bottom, of obtaining the PMC ID number. Stop me if you have any questions, okay? Or just fire them out there. But basically, they've categorized the different types of papers as Method A, Method B, Method C, and Method D. And what defines, you know, which category a paper lands in is either the particular journal that it's in or the particular publishing group that journal belongs to. And that kind of makes things a little complicated. It might take you a little digging in the website to figure out, you know, whether such and such a journal is published by a particular publisher. But you can go to the public access website and you'll see this very table, which I grabbed from it, and you'll see links. And so you can look, and it'll bring up a list of all these Method A journals, for categories B and D, there are certain publishing houses whose journals fall under these categories. So you can click these links to try to resolve it, and ultimately you might have to shoot an email off to the publisher or the journal to get clarification if it's still kind of murky ground.
Dale, can I interrupt you for a second?
Yeah.
So my understanding is that the point is so that articles are freely available to the public. But what about something like Alcohol Research and Health, which is an NIAAA publication that's freely available to the public? We're having trouble with our papers. Probably many of us on the call have a paper in this journal, but there's no PMC ID number, and it comes up as flagged.
That's a good question, a very good question. I don't know the answer to that right off the top of my head, but can look into it. Bill's looking like he might know something.
I don't know. We'd have to look into it. I mean, it's definitely a review article. Most of those are review articles. They are peer reviewed, correct? So they should fall under the policy.
Well, I've been in touch with Barbara Van on this, and she said they're trying to move it forward. She doesn't understand why it doesn't qualify as complying, but it's not in compliance. So
I think the editorial office is working on that to try to make it. That I mean, on the one hand, it already is public access because it's already accessible to everybody,
but it still comes up with a red dot or a yellow dot.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
We will see if we can find anything on this end of things. We can be in touch with
you.
This is Deepak Sarkar. I think for that, you get the PM ID number, but not PMC ID.
Yeah, and let me make a clarification about that, Deepak. There's a lot of acronyms floating around here. Throughout the government, but particularly here, so the PMID just means it's something has been entered into PubMed and can be found there. So anything in PubMed has a PMID.
Right.
But those are not necessarily freely accessible articles, and so that's why PubMed Central came into existence. PMID is not the same as a PMCID. A PMID doesn't get you anywhere in terms of complying with this policy. Is that clear?
Yeah. And this is Bill. I understand the difference is that the stuff in PubMed is just abstracts and titles and authors, and what's in PubMed Central is the full text of the article, and that's the key difference.
Yeah, when they look in... feel very similar for reasons that aren't really important. But so they provide all the same citation number there. But when you drill down and click the link, you might get the author final accepted manuscript that's been dolled up a little bit in PubMed Central. And you will find the links to PubMed Central available papers in PubMed. But it's a different repository, and everything in PubMed Central, unless it's still in an embargo phase, which I'll mention in a moment, is freely accessible. PubMed is a wide open, broad repository of all kinds of papers, many of which are not freely available.
This is Elizabeth. Sarah, where do these yellow and red dots come up? Is it on submission?
No, we had. If you go to, I get, and I, NCBI. It's on NCBI.
Yeah.
Or there's two websites that you need to be checking, and I'm guessing Dale's going to mention them, but one of them is My NCBI, so you have your own account, and one is Jill NIHMS?
NIHMS. Yep.
NIHMS.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And what happens when there's dot? I mean,
it means your articles are out of compliance, and so when that's when bad things happen to you.
Right.
When,
I've had people tell me that I have to be compliant, but I've never had it come to, you know what I mean? I've never.
You have to seek it out. And I mean,
it's connected. You can use your Commons login. Jill might be able to describe it in more detail, but.
Yeah. I'll show something about
okay.
this.
Okay.
As we go on, and so maybe it'll be clearer when we have it in front of our eyes. So, just to briefly go through this.
Originally, when I used to go to PubMed, PMC article number used to show up.
Yeah.
Nowadays, PubMed doesn't show the PMC number, but it's only show pre-PMC article. So, what do I do to get the number?
Right. So that's basically that's what this chart summarizes in a kind of abstract way. So there are different paths that different papers, depending on what journal they're in or what publishing house they fall under, there are different paths that they take. So let me just review them. And these are the ones that are called Method A through D listed on this table. So Method A, these are journals that have worked out an arrangement with NIH, and they will submit the paper to PubMed, and they'll be the final published articles, and the author doesn't have to do anything. And you can go to the website and you can drill down on this link. I guess we could do it now, but I might throw things off here, and see if the journal you're in happens to be among those. Method B also is a method where the publisher does all the work, and. But the difference between A and B is that very often this method B publishers charge you a fee, and it could be as much as $3,000 to get your paper into PubMed Central. And these different ways that the publishers might take to facilitate this process. You know, they're in a sense they're kind of protecting their business model. So they're either capturing $3,000 or whatever they might charge to put it in, or they might have entered into an agreement with NIH. Part of that, those agreements allow these journals to put it in there, but embargo it for 12 months. So it won't be available. It'll have a place in PubMed Central. It might be hidden from view until the day it's out of embargo. But these are ways that the journals have worked out a deal that, in the way I see it, it protects their business model, but does comply with this policy and facilitates the policy. So let's move on to method C and D. These things both involve the MS, which is the NIH Manuscript Submission System, and this is a path to getting your paper to PubMed Central, okay? And what they accept is not the final published article, but the final peer review has all the corrections in it that the revised version with all the final figures, and they get submitted to NIHMS, and they put together a kind of a dolled up manuscript version of that, and they also get you to tell them that there are no copyright issues with them posting it in PubMed Central, and they also have the designated author of the paper to sign off on the fact that when they assembled this dolled up version that they're going to display, that it's accurate and no problems with it. So in this method C, this is where the author submits the manuscript directly to NIHMS, okay? And then there are several steps that are called tasks over here that I've just alluded to, you know, approving this and that as they go along, and making sure that there's not a copyright issue. And so this is all done by the designated author of the paper. And it will initially, when it's going through this process of getting this having this presentable version of it prepared, it's going to temporarily be assigned an NIHMS ID number. And typically the timing while it's in this state prior to being released to PubMed Central and obtaining a PubMed Central ID number it is about a 6 to 8 week period. Anyway, so in the method D, which is applies to certain publishers, among them is John Wiley and Sons, and one of the publications that they hold is the Acer Journal. So that's going to come up frequently in our field, right? But what they soon after it's been accepted for publication, the journal, or maybe it's the publisher, will submit it to NIHMS as the first step. And then the author has to take over. So the author, I believe, will, and some of you can probably speak to this, will receive an email or perhaps a series of emails, you know, prompting them to do the next step and move it through this process. And so if you're in that situation and you are that designated author, you have to kind of can't you just sweep these aside and forget about them, because you might realize a year later when it's time for your progress report that you have dropped the ball and have not gotten to the point where you have the PubMed Central number, which you'll need. And any questions on that before I move on?
I'm just going to pipe in here and say that we found in our experience with the Method D journals, while they will deposit them, you need to initiate the communication with them to ask them to deposit that article for you.
That's a good point, and it never hurts to you know, be vigilant like that. I can relay an experience with a grantee of mine recently, who realized months after the fact, right on the verge of having submitted his progress report, that what was submitted by the journal, it was a Method D submission, had like the cover sheet that made it look like his manuscript, but everything behind it was someone else's manuscript, and it got totally derailed and just languished, and this person neglected the situation as well. You have to keep on top of it, just make sure it's moving along.
Yeah, the other thing I would add, this is Sarah, is that I feel like there is a lot of steps. There are lots of steps that you have to follow, and it really made me sensitive to which journals I would submit to,
mm-hmm.
because I'd much rather submit to a journal that was friendly to this process than to one that was going to make it difficult. We can't go back and change anything in the past, but it does change how I feel about journals. And the other thing is, too, we're always careful about this, so this doesn't really change, but just to reiterate that you would want to be careful about, and I think Dale mentioned this, which grants you're associating with which papers, especially when you're not the primary author or the corresponding author, because it gets really confusing and complicated and could end up causing you problems that you didn't need.
Yeah,
that's
so,
my 2 cents.
You know, one possibility is that other author who is the primary author of that paper maybe dropped the ball and didn't get it into a state of compliance. And so, yeah, you could be exposing yourself in a way by putting that into your grant application progress report. And it gets a little tricky, you know, telling someone else, you know, hey, can you get this moving? I have graduate students who have one of our F grants, who are on a paper with someone from another institution who runs a lab elsewhere, getting caught up in these positions where they want to put this paper on their progress report, or did. And I encourage them to contact the person or talk, you know, via their PI to get it resolved. But yeah, when you get, and I'll make some comments at the very end about kind of implications for consortia like this one. So how are we doing on time, Jill?
This is really important. I think you just run with it.
Okay. Well, I will try to keep it moving here.
Does this concern that Sarah raised mean that it's the confusion is because multiple grants may be supporting the same paper?
Sarah can speak for herself, I guess, but I see this a lot, that, you know, one paper that has multiple grant numbers in it, and this is relevant to consortia, provided that paper is cited in multiple progress reports, they all hinge on that one singular person who overseeing this process of attaining the compliance and ultimately the PMCID number. So, and I'll show you a way you can figure that stuff out here as we move along. And we can talk more. So one of the things that's kind of shaken things up, we've been implementing this policy for quite a while, but not with a lot of teeth. You know, we've been on the lookout for whether people are properly adding the evidence at the end of each citation that they might list in their progress report, you know, whether they have a PMCID number to show or an NIHMS number or a PMC journal in process to add to those citations manually. And when we saw anything that looked like it wasn't really, in compliance because it maybe lacked any of that evidence, we would have to send them this email and tell them which papers appeared to be not in compliance. And they were instructed, you know, to get them in compliance. But I think most program officers had mixed feelings about being the policeman. And so a lot of this just sometimes happened, sometimes didn't happen. And so we've seen a lot of people just year after year sending in these types of progress reports as though they didn't know this policy existed, whereas others seem to catch on and were really good about voluntarily complying.
I would add, I think CFAS as a group has done pretty well with the policy in years past. So
yeah, definitely. So anyway, this notice was issued in mid to late in early 2013. And basically, for certain progress reports that have for type 5s that start July 1, that things were going to change. And they changed in a couple different ways. The first thing highlighted, NIH will delay processing of an award if publications arriving are not in compliance. In other words, if we found that a paper was listed not in compliance, we couldn't issue the award until they resolved it. And the other one was a means of taking the subjectivity of, in a way, or the program officer to program officer variation out of it, was to reconfigure progress reports in ways that they accepted output from my NCBI that in effect is a table, which I'll show you, that automatically figures out if a paper is compliant or not, and we'll look at that in a second. And it's being rolled out. I don't know that this is yet required of you folks with your UO1s and your paper submissions. But
it is. It's part of the PHS 2590, so it is. and we're requiring it on the mid-years due on November 11th.
Okay, good. Anyway, but this is the new letter that we send out that's coupled with the release of this notice, and I've circled, your award may be delayed until these issues are resolved. That's one point. That's the scary stuff. And it gets grantees very anxious. And this one person I told you that had the mix up in their method D submission, where the cover sheet didn't match the rest of the stack of papers that were submitted by the journal. He also had one of those papers that was in method B. Remember, that's where the journals often they'll do it for you, but they'll exact a price often. So he had to pay $3,000 to get one paper in compliance and then had to struggle with the other one. And so that one went unfunded for about a month and a half because he wasn't on top of this before getting to the point of submitting a progress report. So get on top of it. And technically, if you look at the letter of the law here, as soon as a paper is accepted, you should be initiating this process of getting things in compliance. But so that should be your trigger for getting going. And then, you know, follow it through until it gets all the way to the PubMed central ID number. Okay, so coming back. So the other thing that I'm pointing to here is this PDF compliance report. So when they first rolled this idea out of using MyNCBI to generate a table of papers and determine their compliance status, the idea was that this would all be electronic. But then they realized, oh, well, we have paper applications and progress reports coming in too. And so they developed this way of also using MyNCBI to just produce a PDF that you could print out and collate with your paper application or progress report. And this is actually a pretty handy tool. And whenever I have grantees that and I'm reviewing the progress report and I see issues of compliance, I will send them this link because it tells them how to generate this report. And so they might have generated one in the first place, but it wasn't showing complete compliance. They had to deal with that. And I tell them when they've got it done, generate this PDF report that I'm pointing to the link of, and then send it my way, and then we can move on. And so this is just a drill down to what that link shows you. And it's essentially, and I think Sarah and others can vouch for this, I can't because I don't see this from my end, but this is what you're going to basically be seeing, a list of papers on the left in MyNCBI that are your papers. And they show a couple steps here and this button right here to generate this PDF report. And it looks
Elizabeth, that's where the red and yellow dots are.
Oh, yeah.
On all green dots.
Look for it.
Yeah, there you go.
And just to let everybody know, when you used to log into ERA Commons, you used to have all your bibliography stored in ERA Commons. They have transitioned over to this MyNCBI. So this is that new piece.
Right here. Okay, so one point here is this is the same So this same system generates a table that gets electronically inserted into electronic progress reports, but in case of paper ones, it can be printed out as a PDF, as I mentioned, and collated and sent along. And the other thing is it's not like reporting, using this PDF report button, it doesn't tell us anything about what you're doing over there. So why not play around with it before you get too close to the deadline for your progress report and get familiar with it and print out the report and see what it says in these columns. All these completes mean that it's compliant, and you can see a PubMed Central, a PMC number, associated with each of these that say complete, PMC. You see that? And then others are, but this one is kind of in that transitional phase. It's compliant, provided it's not 3 years past, 3 months past its publication date, and it shows an NIH MSID number, but I know that this is a compliant status. If we were to receive this, these are all examples of compliant papers, but just that two of them are at an earlier stage. They haven't yet been issued their PMC ID number, yet they have an NIHMS ID number that will make them compliant at that early stage. Clear enough?
So, Dale, if it has an NIHMS number, so it says in progress or in process, but it's more than 3 months, that means it's out of compliance, right?
This status will change. The electronic system, you know, has algorithms that will put something else here that says not compliant or non-compliant.
And it gets a red dot.
Yeah, so having
you have an NIHMS number, it's not good enough if it's gone too long. We're struggling with another journal. I can't remember which category they're in, but they're not friendly. and we won't submit to them again. But it's just taking a really, really long time.
Yeah, so the NIHMS ID number is time sensitive. It's good at a certain point in time prior to 3 months after publication, but beyond that, you need PMC number.
Can I ask a question?
Yep.
For the example that you have here, it looks like you filtered by a publication year. When these guys are doing their progress reports, they should click under the awards all of the times their award appears, correct, for the particular grant?
I can't answer that question. I haven't laid hands on the working end of this.
Okay. I'm pretty sure that's what you'll want to do, but I do want to caution everyone that even though, you know, in April, you know, our progress reports will be reviewed by NIH, that even grants, like, you're held liable both as a PI for every grant that you have and every paper you've written, and that comes into play even when you're submitting your consortium progress report. If you have an R01 grant that doesn't have something in compliance, they'll hold it up for that as well. Is that correct?
Listed in the Type 5, then it would be held up. I mean, if it wasn't listed in the progress report, then no, there wouldn't be any way that we could tell. Does that answer your question, Jill?
Yeah, I guess maybe we were in a unique situation with the T32 just because it was so broad, so maybe that was just for that situation.
But you could easily see how one paper that was not in compliance among the PIs in this consortium could hold up many of the awards. So I think we're very interdependent when it comes to a consortium to make sure the policy is being followed.
Okay, moving along. Bill just stole my thunder here. I was going to say what he said. So anyway, multidisciplinary publications might be authored by multiple, if not all, consortia PIs, right? This is, I put it in generic terms, but I'm talking about you guys because you do have many papers where multiple PIs who are, you know, have to submit progress reports each year and may want to list these papers and probably should in their progress report. So, and you guys, I think, all have the same budget start date, not start date. And just having one of these types of papers that's not compliant coming in on all those progress reports could delay the funding of all the components. And it could take a month or two to resolve. So you guys have to, you know, make sure you're all clear on, you know, who's in charge. I guess you always have a lead author, but make sure you understand that someone is in charge and going to take care of obtaining compliance for these multi-PI publications. And that's all I had.
That's enough.
But is it too much?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway. Thanks for your attention.
Yeah. No, that's really helpful. And having just gone through the process, it is a little harrowing.
Yeah. And we see it from a different angle. So, you know, I've tried to interject into here how we receive these and what we're on the lookout for and have to be on the lookout for, and how we would go about harassing you if we had to.
With the help of both Bill and Dale, I put together kind of a quick link sheet that I can send out to everyone, and I also went through many of the publications that we published to find their actual policy and to give you the email or the form that you need to do to help you I kind of made a cheat sheet for some of them. So hopefully that'll help you guys a little bit.
That's great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Can we get a copy of these slides, too, Dale, to just post up?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So the last, thank you very much for that. That was really helpful. And again, until you start doing it, some of this might sound like it was a different language, but once you start, it's really going to make sense. The last couple of things on the agenda I'll talk about real quick. I am going to send out a doodle poll for those of you that haven't done a WebEx presentation yet, which I think that's a large majority of you, because I think I only have Eberhardt, Sulik, and Mattson as having done them so far. We'll have a sign up for that so that we can have one on the December call. Just a note, because January 1st is the first Wednesday, we're going to go ahead and make that January 8th for that call, because that's a holiday for most of us. Second thing is the face-to-face meetings. The reason April, that week of April 7th, worked for everyone, with the exception of Ed. So he's probably going to be giving the welcoming address at that Canada Adult FASB meeting that starts on that Wednesday. So I'm going to send out a doodle poll, and hopefully for some reason we can all maybe pop in for a weekend day, but I'll send out a doodle poll to see what works out best for everyone with that. And then the last thing is, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that week doesn't work for me. This is Bill Barnett. I thought I responded to that doodle poll.
The week of the 7th doesn't work for you either?
That's right.
Okay. I know we're not going to find something that works for everyone, but in looking what people came back with March, it looks like more of a mess than April. So I'll give us some options. We'll finalize it, and we'll go with it. And then the last thing is that your mid-year progress reports are due to me on the 11th, and part of that is the PDF of your grant compliance, publication compliance. So get those going, and I sent a template to all of you, and it's also at the bottom of the conference call email, so let me know if you have any questions, and I guess we really maybe don't have time for project updates today. Jen, you want to take over from here?
Yeah, no, we don't have any more time for, unless anybody has any, in the last 2 minutes, anything exciting they want to share.
Any concerns, troubleshooting?
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone. Thanks, Bill and Dale. And,
thank you.
We'll talk in a month.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Unless you're coming to neuroscience, in which we'll see you.
Bye.
Bye.